The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Now, I'm joined in the studio by Jennifer Carroll McNeill, the Minister for Health, and Fine Gael TD for Dunleary. Good morning to you, and thank you for coming in. News this morning that you've reached agreement now with the pharmacists on blister packs, mm-hmm. and some people were expecting a charge might come in today, in fact, in relation to this. So what's happening? Is the government now going to pay pharmacists to do this job?
So no, we're not. The situation has always been, and we reached agreement last June, the state has never funded blister packs. Mm-hmm. Never. Blister packs are a medicine tool that pharmacists use sometimes to help people who are struggling, maybe a little bit more vulnerable, but it's not something that the state has ever paid for.
They were charging for something else when they were doing it, weren't they?
That's exactly it. And it gets a bit complicated. So for example, there was people who were getting blister packs who were paying for it privately. It was a matter of convenience. Some people were getting it for free because the pharmacist was paying for it, was just giving it to them for free, was just absorbing that effort. And others, though, very unfortunately, were giving it to the patient for free, but were charging the state under a totally different scheme, a phased dispensing scheme. And that is a scheme that where we give medication to people on a daily or weekly basis because they're quite high risk medications. Mm-hmm. And we pay pharmacists to do that. So last June, we reached agreement with pharmacists on a whole range of things, a large fee increase, the new community, the common condition scheme. So now you can go into your pharmacist and get a diagnosis for conjunctivitis or urinary tract infection and pay the pharmacist and get your prescription there. And then you don't need to go to a doctor. These are all new things that we're doing with pharmacists. And we also, to recognise what had been happening, where there was a very large amount of inappropriate claiming by some pharmacists, a small number, but importantly, tens of millions of euros every year, to end that practice and to clarify what phase dispensing what would be for the future. Of course, it was a source of disappointment to me, and I think to people generally who had concluded the agreement, that there was a reaction by, again, some pharmacists who were purporting to now introduce a charge for blister packs where, you know, they hadn't before, and they were aligning that to the change, mm-hmm. the new agreement. It's really important. I mean, I don't want to focus too much on the probity issue. It is very important from taxpayer perspective. I do want to talk about patients, but just for people to be aware, we have reached a number of settlements over the last number of years, including ongoing today, settlements with pharmacists who were inappropriately claiming under that scheme. And I mean, if I can give you an example, charging the state for phase dispensing over 7 days where they were only open for 6 days, or charging the state maybe if Mrs. Murphy, for example, gets 10 medications and they were putting it in a blister pack, the pharmacist gets a fee per medication generally for dispensing the fee to the medicine, say of €4. And Mrs. Murphy came in on the first of the month and she got all her medications and the pharmacist was correctly charging, say, €40 for the dispensing of those 10 medications. But then in week 2, 3 and 4, where she never came back into the pharmacy, we're also charging the state for phased dispensing an mm-hmm. additional €3 per medication.
But
so
then they would
very
say,
considerably. Well, no, it was wrong. It was wrong,
but they would say that they were spending up to 45 minutes putting these into a blister pack and there was no way for them to charge for that.
Well, there was, because there's lots of pharmacists charging for that for many years and there's lots of patients charging for that.
It.
And so, it's not correct. I mean, I heard it on radio yesterday to say that just because the state doesn't provide it, we should then charge under a different scheme. Most pharmacists never did that and never would do that. And I was really struck, Claire, when all of this came out in November, how many pharmacists got in touch with me to say that doesn't that sort of conduct doesn't represent them, that they want to see this shut down and they want to see it named and in a very direct way.
So
that has shut down.
What is happening today then? What is this announcement?
So this announcement then is, so it's clear though that, like, with the agreement there needed to be better implementation from the IPU and from ourselves. And so what we've done is we've changed the agreement that we reached last June to make it just a little simpler. So what we will do now is we are giving, instead of allowing a phase dispensing scheme where you charge under that scheme, we're going to give a medicines optimization fee, you know, on a per patient basis, so that pharmacists have a fee to look after that patient, so that the pharmacist will use their clinical judgment as to what best does that patient need. Do they need weekly or daily dispensing? Do they need additional aids, additional supports? One of those might be a blister pack. But again, I have to be very honest and transparent and say that the science shows and the international evidence shows that that is one of the tools that you should look to at the end, mm-hmm. it's not brilliant. But, I assume that it's really convenient. I assume that it's really brilliant. But actually, when you take medication out of its original packaging, you can create, it can become mm-hmm. destabilized. You can't go back to the original recall dates. It's not a perfect system.
But we do know some people are used to it.
And that's fine.
So if the pharmacist has to do that for certain patients, can they charge for that on this sliding scale
now? They will get it under this, that we were giving them a fee to look after the patient and then they can use their clinical judgment. What does that mean, though, if you're the person who's been receiving the blister pack? If you are a medical card patient, which is the only person that the only people that phase dispensing ever applied to. Mm-hmm. If you're a medical card patient and you were receiving a blister pack up to, say, August last year, you will continue to get that for free. Then for the future, we have changed the clinical criteria to make it tighter and more specific, and the pharmacist will use their clinical judgment for the future. If you're a private patient, then it really is a matter between you and your pharmacist, as it always has been. There has never mm-hmm. been any change.
So you may be charged, but you may always have been charged.
Okay. And the real extraordinary thing is, you know, the dialogue was this was a cut by the government or this was a fee cut. Like, we have to be really clear. This mm-hmm. was a wrong use of funds, and we have tightened it up and clarified it so that we can use that money, tens of millions of euros a year, for other things for the benefit of patients.
So if I'm a medical card patient and I go in for an antibiotic, I just get that the pharmacist will just get the dispensing fee for my antibiotic. But if somebody goes in with additional requirements, the pharmacist will get more than the dispensing fee for looking after that person.
Yeah, because if you think about it, I mean, people are in very different circumstances. If you go in for an antibiotic, they give you the dispensing fee, that's fine, grant, and you pay for it, no problem. There's other people who really need a lot more support, who are much more vulnerable. People in, you know, maybe people with dementia, maybe with particular addictions, maybe people who are, you know, I don't want to create categories, but the categories that we might look at are people who are socially excluded or homeless.
Isn't that fair? But who's looking at that? Who's making sure that the person who's picking up the antibiotics is not that the pharmacist isn't getting a higher fee for that than they should be?
So the HSE. So we have a system in the HSE where we track all of the spending, and it's because of that that I'm able to come into you and say that I am very aware of wrong and erroneous charging under that scheme. It is that information that the HSE uses, for example, to take major court cases against pharmacist chains and individual pharmacies. There are settlements concluding as we speak in mm-hmm. relation to wrong charging. Because of the scale of it, the HSE did write to the Garda Commissioner to look for support from the Garda Economic Crime Bureau to give additional support, because it's such a detailed investigation. It involves every single receipt, you know, did the doctor prescribe it, and so on and so on and so on. And it is complicated. And I'm very aware that as I sit here, this is a complicated.
But you believe there may have been criminal activity going on here?
I want to be very careful because I don't want to step across anything that happens in the future, or an investigation that happens in the future. But it is certainly the case that we have concluded settlements and that there is a very significant pattern of charging that is not appropriate. And it is always, when you're talking about, this is not victimless behaviour. If you are not, you know, like, I want to be really careful with my language so I don't prejudice anything in the future, but it is not victimless behaviour to wrongly charge the taxpayer for something that you know mm-hmm. not to be correct. The HSE issued circulars. There have been agreements concluded that show in courts that show that this is not the correct way to do things. And it is important on behalf of the taxpayer that is investigated fully.
But is there a cost to the HSE in what you're announcing today? Because the Irish Pharmacy Union has welcomed this, which tells me that they're happy that you've done. So what are they getting in return here?
I'm very glad that they've welcomed it, because we've been working with them for some time, not just on this, but also on the previous agreement. So this is a good thing to put this to bed. This all comes out of the same budget envelope as was the case last summer. So we're not spending additional money on it. We are repurposing the money that was in the original agreement. And I think why pharmacists will welcome it is because the vast majority of them are not engaged in this behaviour mm-hmm. and don't want to be associated with it. That's the very clear message from individual pharmacists to me. They'll also welcome it, I hope, because this provides additional clarity and administrative ease for them, particularly when supporting their more vulnerable patients. And that's really, really important. And it also enables them to just move on for the future. There's pharmacists up and down the country. Like, we, I think we have close to 95% of pharmacists are implementing the Common Condition Scheme, which is absolutely transformative for pharmacy, for community pharmacy.
For their diagnosing.
Yeah, I mean, this is talking about, this is pharmacists working at the top of their qualifications. These are medical practitioners. Mm-hmm. They're not shopkeepers. They are qualified medical practitioners, and they should be enabled to work at the top of their profession. That means me being, or you being able to go in and get a diagnosis and an antibiotic. And we've started with 8 conditions. I would like to see that extended, but it needs a chance to be implemented. Mm-hmm. It's going well so far from what I hear from people and what I hear from pharmacists. And I'm sure that everybody wants to focus on what more can pharmacists do for their community rather than something that is, frankly, a negative practice by a tiny minority of pharmacists from the past that just doesn't need to be
so
there anymore.
So phase dispensing will only happen, or the payments will only be made for phase dispensing when that is what pharmacists are doing.
So they will get a fee from now on, and it is their clinical judgment as to how best to support their mm-hmm. GMS, their medical card patient. It's really important that pharmacists use their clinical judgment. If they can use their clinical judgment in diagnosing your conjunctivitis or my conjunctivitis, then they can do so with this as well. They are medical practitioners, and we need them to use more of their clinical judgment, not less.
They'll be watched very closely, I would imagine, is also the message.
I think that's fair.
Okay. Let's move to the Children's Hospital.
Sure.
When's it going to open?
It will open about 7 months after we get full control over the hot block. That's the key thing. What's the hot block? The hot block. So I'm going to the Children's Hospital this morning, actually. So, I mean, look, I know it's a long story, but I can't tell you how magnificent it is, really, for children. It is totally, totally different. We have total control over floor 6. It's fitted out completely. We will be able to take additional floors with bedrooms. But the bit that really matters, Claire, is floor 1 and floor 2. Why? Because that's where critical care is. That's where the surgeries are. That's where the laboratories are. And the laboratory piece is the piece that takes the longest. So once we get control of that from the contractor, who still holds the keys to it, and we can't get into it until they finish their work there and give it to us. Mm-hmm. But once we do, it'll take us about 7 months to commission the laboratory equipment in particular. Believe me, I have tried everything to figure out a shorter timeline for that. And we have moved it down from 12 months to 9 months to 7 months. I've even tried, can we test the laboratory equipment somewhere else and then move it in? No, it has to be calibrated perfectly on site. That's the bit that's going to take us the longest. But none of that matters until we get access to the building, early access to the building, and the contractor is in control of that.
And now, you don't have a date.
Well, I could give you a date, but I mean, what I want is access. Like, we got early access to in December, and we've used that really well. So we got early access from the contractor. Children's Health Ireland moved in. We've cleaned the areas. We've fitted it out with beds. We've fitted it out and with all of the technology. We've put in the pharmacy robots, the pharmacy equipment. So the bits where we have had access to, by God, have we used that time. And even then, we've used it in a preparatory way for other parts. Like, we've been building and storing equipment in those mm-hmm. areas that we have control so that we can flush that out. But yeah. We need access to the hospital.
I mean, BAM says that delays are due to the changes that have been asked of
sure.
them.
Yeah.
I'm just not
accepting it at all. Like, this is a long-standing story. Like, at the end of the day, I have been there several times. I don't see the number of people that should be there to be able to finish the job. I don't see the practicality being applied that needs to be applied. They do not, and they historically have not had, and they would say that they do, but the reality is that they need an awful lot more staff to finish the job quickly. If you're getting your house done, an extension done to your mm-hmm. house, and they need 10 people to finish it in the next 2 weeks, and they have 2 people there instead. Now, I'm giving an analogy, as you understand. It's not going to get done, is it? You need 15 people there to finish the job on time, quickly, in the way that you committed to. These are, by the way, let's be really clear, BAM's own timelines. They're not my timelines. They're the contractor's timelines, and they miss them again and again and again. But you know what, Claire? I'm going to be really practical about this. I will take what is appropriate for us to take that meets the clinical standards that we need. We're not going to take something that's at a substandard clinical standard. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't accept that either.
But if that was happening in my house, just to continue mm-hmm. with you, I'd just stop paying them.
Okay, so let's talk that through. What happens then to the building of the Children's Hospital? Well, now, there are contractual mechanisms executing.
But if what you're saying is right, they're just carrying on yeah. with the shortfall in the staff yeah. numbers because they're getting away with it. Now, I know BAM will push back against this and yeah. they will say, and they're entitled sure. to say that. But if we carry on with what you're saying, then if they're getting away with it, they're not going to change what they're doing. So you have to withhold something.
So we are doing that. And there's a series of bonds being withheld by the development board. And there's a series of contractual levers that we are executing and we are pulling. Mm-hmm. But that still doesn't deliver a change in behaviour so far. And it still doesn't deliver the people that we need on site to complete the hospital. So, you know, there is a bit of a bind there, of course, because I want the hospital finished, you want the hospital finished, but we also have to stand up for the taxpayer and we have to stand up for the patient. So here's the things that we're not going to be doing. We're not going to be taking anything that's not at the appropriate clinical standard, and we're not going to be accepting anything. We're not going to be paying out in any way to get the, you know what I mean? Like the contract has to be met. It's as simple as that. And mm-hmm. We need to get, but what I can assure people is that where we get access to different parts of the hospital, boy oh boy, are we using that appropriately.
The chief officer of the board says that there are lessons to be learned. We've heard this before. There are lessons to be learned. Yep. What are the lessons?
Well, I think if you go back to the contractual structure around 2015, 2016, state was in a very, very different place. And that was what they agreed at that time. We'd obviously not do that again. You know, we'd have much clearer, I think as well, if you look at the pressure to take, I don't want to be too pejorative, but there was a pressure at a particular point in the recovery, in the economic recovery, to always take the cheapest thing. It's not necessarily the cheapest thing long run. Mm-hmm. Can I say that we don't do this in respect of the contracts that we are engaging in now? For example, we have had in the Department of Health very successful contracts with contractors in Limerick, for example, finishing the 96 bed block, a huge, you know, huge mm-hmm. projects on time, on budget. We're building surgical hubs that are being delivered on time, on budget.
But this one was a doozy. This one is a disaster. But, you know 18 like, times it's been delayed
That's all true. But you know what I'm focused on is just getting it open, mm-hmm. getting the children in. And I do accept that there's a long history to it. And I can spend a lot of time thinking about that, or I can turn up today at the Children's Hospital and say, what are you doing today and tomorrow and over the next 2 weeks that's going to get me access to the hot block?
But to avoid this happening again, the learnings need to happen.
That's
and
true.
And do you think somebody should be held accountable for this contract?
You know what I'm concerned about is getting the hospital opened. And then I'm concerned about making sure that we get the right contract in respect of all of our other projects in the Department of Health. The evidence that I see is that that is happening. I'm interested in getting this hospital open. And to be honest with you, I am so busy doing that, that if there's, you know, if Deeper want to look at the contractual structure or something else, grand, fine, but I've enough to be doing to get this hospital open.
And I know you're looking at the staffing as well, because Lucy Nugent said last week 570 people need to be employed.
Over time.
That's an extraordinary figure though. And some of the staff in the existing hospitals, they don't want to move to the new one for various reasons.
Sure, that's a matter for themselves.
Are you concerned about that? That's a very high number of people to find.
So that's over a period of years. That's not all like next Tuesday. Mm-hmm. That's over a period of years. So this is a big hospital and its staffing complement will not be the same on day one as it is on day 5,000. This is something that will grow and grow and grow naturally. You know, like we have a very considerable number of vacancies in the Department of Health that we are actively recruiting for, consultant positions most notably. They are hard to get. We're competing internationally and we are increasing our numbers all of the time. And the evidence is there that we have the funding, that we are increasing numbers, but it is hard to recruit people. Like, for example, it's hard to recruit spinal surgeons. It has taken us a long time to recruit the three that we have just hired. And even then, we have to wait for them to complete different fellowships or complete their contracts in other places. Mm-hmm. So it is difficult. But I think what we have done there, what Lucy and I have done, is set an ambition for the number of people that we believe will be working there. But on day one, you know, the staff from Crumlin and Temple Street, it's part of their contract. They will transition to the Children's Hospital. That is the new place of work. Temple Street will cease to.
Oh, so they can't say, I don't want to move.
Anybody can say, I don't want to move. But Temple, you can't stay in Temple Street because it's not going to be a functional hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is a normal employment law. If the place of work moves,
you move with it.
Like if News Talk moved, you'd move, Claire.
Lucy,
you know,
because Lucy Nugent said that the hospital does need 500 staff on day one. So that not all of them will need to be recruited. Is that what you're saying?
Right. So
some of them will come from the other hospitals.
Overwhelmingly, the people will come from the other hospitals. Mm-hmm. And I've spoken to people there. They're looking forward to moving to the new hospital. Yeah, they're excited about it.
I know you were concerned because I read it previously. You said you were lying awake thinking about that movement of children, very sick children. Yeah. Has that been worked out yet, how that will happen?
Yeah, so we're aware, in the sense that we know exactly what's involved. What we don't know is the timing and how best to do that. What Lucy is doing quite well is she's going and visiting other places where significant moves like that were done at different stages of the winter, or the summer, and the different time of year. What does that mean? We don't know, for example, what stage of respiratory illness will be in the hospital system. Like, so for example, it's particularly important this year that you and I get our flu vaccine so that respiratory illness is minimized as much as possible. Why? Because that means the hospital systems are less under pressure generally. Mm-hmm. It means there's more ambulances. So there's a lot of variables that you, that I can't answer for you today because they're variables.
Well, also you don't know when you're going to have the hospital. So you don't know who's going to be there. You don't know what stage people are going to be at.
But what we're doing is we're trying to test things in different scenarios at different times of the year. And what does that mean? There was a view that nothing could be done in the winter. We went and tested and pushed that view a little further. Turns out perhaps there can in certain circumstances. What we will do is we will move children when it is safe and when it is right.
You mentioned shortages across the system, and people will know that it's very difficult to get an appointment with your GP. Some people, when they move to a new area, they can't get a GP at all. We know in particular rural areas are affected by this. Do you think at this stage that GPs need to be incentivised to open new practices or to expand?
Well, so we do have very significant supports for GPs. Like, the state does give a substantial amount of money through the contract to GPs, whether it's chronic disease management or a whole range of different things.
Is it enough? Because of the problem that we have?
Well, we do have increasing number of GPs all of the time. The Medical Council is registering them. I see those numbers. But we don't have enough to keep pace with population. We've obviously increased the numbers in training. We've increased the number in universities. We've even developed courses in Galway, for example, about the about being a rural GP. We've tried to support GP practices in primary care centres. There's a whole range of different things that we can do. And we are trying, but can I just say, it's not just GPs. What I've described to you about the community pharmacy is as important, because if you don't have to go to your GP to get a basic prescription, that frees up space in that GP's office for something else. So it's a complete approach to trying to increase access to care in every way. Yes, we do need more GPs. Yes, our population is rising and we need more of them. And we will always go back to the GP contract and develop that over time. And I'm in discussions with the IMO at an early stage in relation to that strategic review of GP practice and how that's delivered. But the numbers are increasing, but I don't think it's a one size fits all. The community pharmacy agreement is as important.
Okay, I want to ask you about a woman we had in here in News Talk called Dervla Brogan.
Yes, I heard her.
We were honoured to have her come to us to tell us about her experience with pregnancy loss and fetal abnormality. And we'll have a listen just to a quick clip of what Dervla had to say.
Saying this out loud actually makes me think I'm such a bad person, but just if somebody else is going through it and they need to hear it, we would go into the scans nearly hoping that there wouldn't be a heartbeat because the decision would have been made for us. Mm-hmm. And that's not a position you ever want to be in. Mm-hmm. If we could have been looked after here, I believe it could have been quicker. The travelling, like the flying, the whole process, booking the flights, booking the hotel, picking the clinic, all of those things together just add to the mental load that you're going through at the time.
Just to explain to people, Dervla, she couldn't get a definitive diagnosis. Mm-hmm. She knew that her baby wouldn't survive outside of the womb. She didn't have the definitive diagnosis. She made the decision that she had to travel. So my question to you is, are you satisfied that the law around termination of pregnancy in a situation like that, that that law is working in practice?
Well, it isn't if she had that experience, you know, and I say that with great sympathy and great empathy for her. I did hear her, and any woman who has lost a pregnancy in any way knows the trauma of that and the difficulty of that. To have to go through that and travel with all of that additional stress, indignity and discomfort in every possible way just makes that so much worse. There is quite a lot of disagreement as to the future for that. I mean, look, there have been reviews of the Act and there have been reviews of how to make better diagnosis and better clarity for clinicians and to make this process easier and so on. But that's not what Dervla is talking about. She's talking about a change to the Health Act, and I'm very aware of that. My own personal view is that people should be able to get care at home. But I respect very clearly that there are a lot of different views in government, that there isn't consensus in relation to reviewing the Health Act or changing the Health Act on a number of different fronts. And I take those opinions very seriously, as well as, you know, articulating my own perspective. I have listened to women who have needed care at home. I have listened to women who have travelled or who have had terminations and who told me that they regretted it. I've listened to the pro-life. I've met the pro-life group. I've tried to listen to as many different people as possible and respect every single view. But my own personal view is that I would much prefer that the circumstances that Dervla found herself in, that she could have gotten care closer to home. And I appreciate that the Act is a barrier to that. And I'm very open to that, to changes to that personally and as Minister for Health. But I also respect the fact that I work in a government where there isn't a convergence of
There isn't consensus on this. So you're saying even if you wanted to push for a change, you're not confident that you could get there.
I think I'd be much more gentle than even that. I think it's really important that we hear from Dervla. I think it's really important that we hear her story and the awful practicality of what she experienced along with the trauma of losing a baby. I think it's important that women shouldn't have to do this, of course, in my opinion, but it is really important that we hear women's stories from maternity where it is so difficult, and it can be so difficult, because the truth is it does change culture and it does change perspectives and it does change outcomes over time, and we know that in lots of different fields. So I think what she did was really important. I'm so sorry that that's what she went through. I'm so, so sorry that that's what she went through, or that any woman goes through that. And I understand that the constraints of the Act add to that. Now, I also understand that, you know, when I step back and I behave as a lawyer again, and I realise that you have to set timelines and you have to set something in the Act. You know, at the moment it says that that death essentially would happen within 28 days. Mm-hmm. And how can a clinician be certain of that? 28 days, is it arbitrary? Should it be 56 days? There have been efforts in the Dáil to increase that up to a year. That's not something I'd personally agree with either.
With Dervla's case, though, it was that everybody was agreed that her baby wouldn't survive. It was getting a diagnosis for the condition. That was the delay. And she felt that every day that passed, you know, left her in a more difficult situation. And she just booked her.
Of course it did.
On the day she was travelling, she got the news.
Yeah, she got the news that it was a diagnosis.
Yeah, but she decided to go anyway. So that was a pace, really. That was that she wasn't getting the results of those tests back quickly.
Yeah, and I spoke with Cullum Henry, our Chief Clinical Officer, this morning in relation to that. And, you know, there has been a review into how that is done and that fatal abnormality. The Regan report that has been done, and there is a series of recommendations around diagnostic clarity, timelines and so on, and they are being implemented, and I will stay on top of that with him, because of course that timeline is very important. But it still doesn't answer the broader question around there will be a different woman who doesn't have the clarity. She may have a diagnosis, but she doesn't have the clarity as to the fatal element or the timeline element of it. And what I'm saying is that I do hear that.
Okay. Just more generally, I wanted to ask you about what you expect will happen with government interventions on fuel and cost of living as this conflict continues in the Middle East. Do you expect energy credits to be back on the table before the budget, certainly?
I'm sorry, I just cannot answer that at this point, because, first of all, I don't think we have any sense yet of quite how significant this energy crisis is and what that's going to mean and how long it lasts. We are living on a day-to-day basis on the comments made internationally by different political leaders in the US and in the Middle East. I don't have an answer to that, and I don't want to be dishonest to anybody and say that I do or I can pretend I do. I think we need to establish the facts. The government has made changes to try to reduce costs in some way. There is no government in the world that is going to be able to meet the costs of this for every part of their society. We see internationally governments introducing restrictions on fuel usage, restrictions on car usage. We are fortunate that our oil isn't necessarily directly coming from this region, and that gives us a buffer that other countries don't have. But this is a serious fuel crisis, and we will respond as best we can. But there is no government in the world that is going to be able to meet every cost associated with this.
Every penny that is spent mitigating, somebody this has to come from somewhere. And when you go looking for your budget, then ahead of the budget, that's impacted. That figure's impacted.
Yes, exactly. And I, of course, will make the best case I can for increasing the health budget. But I do that as part of a collective government trying to take responsibility for everybody's well-being. My constituents need support with fuel costs as much as they need a good healthcare system. And the truth of government is that you're trying to do the best for the maximum number of people in the maximum way, but you're doing that all of the time with finite resources, and you have to try and decide how best to allocate that at any given moment.
And can you tell us, is there talk at government level about asking people to conserve fuel, perhaps work from home more?
That's, you know, that not yet, but you know, I again, I don't want to speculate it to the future, and again, it's not my brief, but it's it, like, I think that you have to be aware that this is an important and significant energy crisis, as much because of what has been destroyed as the disruption to supply at the moment, and we don't know what the consequences of that are going to be.
Now, just before we let you go, you've news for us on the extension of the bowel screening programme. What's happening with that?
Yes, very, very pleased to announce an extension to that today, so that that will eventually bring us up to, from the age of 50 to 74, and I'm very, very pleased to be able to announce that it's an important part of our healthcare screening. Bowel cancer impacts far too many people, and early diagnosis is incredibly important. I think what's really important as well is we've also we find out that. Could I ask people, if you do are already included in the screening program, please turn up for your appointment. We have a disproportionately high number of do not attends in this screening program, which A, okay, costs us money if you don't attend your appointment, but B, if you don't attend your appointment, then it's not going to get picked up and the consequences can be very severe. So please, please attend.
People from the age of 50 up now will be screened or offered screening.
We're extending in that way. The other thing is then we will be, through the community pharmacy agreement as well, we are enabling pharmacists to register people who are of an appropriate age to go and get to get the kit, which can be sent to your home. So please, either through your pharmacy, please, my message is just, I can extend the age all I like. If people don't take up bowel screening, they're not going to be protected from colon cancer. So whatever, you know, it's great to extend it, but what's really important with bowel cancer screening is that people attend the appointments. So I'm begging you, please, please attend it. It has a lower attendance rate than the other screening programs. So please attend.
All right. Minister, thank you very much for coming in. That's Minister Jennifer Carroll McNeill. We'll take a break.
The Clare Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.